session number 11307, reel 4.
Lieutenant Commander Raymond Adams, reel 4.
We decided about 1745 to go to action stations, which is one of the three times we went to action stations during the whole campaign. Once was on the first morning, because going to dawn action stations was the thing. And the other was on the first day when we were bombarding Stanley Airfield. And this third one, as I was saying earlier, the reason for going to action stations didn't provide any more fighting capability, but provided more damage control capability. It also meant people were up and about and in the right rig if there was a problem. At shortly after 6 o'clock, we had news that there was an attack coming out, and we were steaming at that point in an easterly direction on our patrol line when two Skyhawks came very quickly off the land and obviously coming to us. We attempted to engage with Sea Dart. Broadsword Sea Wolf didn't fire for one reason or another. And we engaged with our gun. I'm not sure whether they actually dropped any weapons, but nothing hit us. And what must have been about 2 or 3 seconds later, two more Skyhawks came very low off the land at about 90 degrees to the first lot. And because broadswords weapons didn't fire the first time, we decided to open our weapon arcs by altering course, and we came hard around to starboard to engage. And that put ourselves between broadsword and the aircraft. We engaged with the gun and also with Sea Dart, but with land in the background, it was very difficult to get a good target, and also with our close range weapon systems, i.e., our 20mm guns. These other two aircraft came in and dropped four bombs. Three hit us, and one hit one went through broadsword's flight deck. We were also apparently strafed with 30mm cannon fire, which we wasn't aware about at the time. And we believe we hit the aircraft with a number of rounds of 20mm fire. As we finished the turn and steadied up, there was a sort of dull thud. We had already hit the deck and taken cover on this. But within 30 seconds or so, standing on the bridge was full of smoke, despite the fact the bombs hit 4 or 5 decks below us. Two, I believe, went off immediately, and one went off very shortly afterwards by sympathetic detonation. It was quite obvious at that stage we had a major problem, and we lost our steering. We transferred to after steering, i.e. on the tiller flat, but we were losing some of our engine power. The ops room and crews from between decks evacuated very quickly because of the smoke, and in fact within seconds most of the ops room crew were already out on the bridge and on the upper deck, and as I said, the bridge was covered in smoke anyway. Having got people out, there were obviously a number of burn cases, and we were then looking around what to do next, but it was fairly apparent within minutes that all we were going to do is go for a swim. Within about 5 minutes, the ship was heeling 15, 20 degrees to port. The aircraft had gone, and at this stage we had very little in the way of power and resources that I was aware of. The main broadcast had gone, and there was no way we could tell everyone to abandon ship, but the whole business seemed to happen anyway. I walked around the signal deck to make sure my lads were all right, and they seemed quite unharmed and were fine. A lot of people were still pouring onto the upper deck, because in the thick smoke there's no way you could survive between decks. And it was obvious that there was a great deal of water coming into the ship. Within 10 or 15 minutes, the port gunwale was underwater, i.e. the water was up to the level of the deck on the port side, and of course we were heeling very heavily to port. At this point we were myself and another couple of officers and a group of sailors were launching life rafts down the starboard side and inflating them. These are the canistered inflatable life rafts. And scrambling as we're going over the side as well. We dressed in our once-only suits, although most of us put them on in quite a hurry.
What are once-only suits?
A once-only suit is a rubber suit, which is made of day-glow orange, with a hood and arm pieces to keep you totally covered, and in theory, watertight. In practice, most of us put it on horribly wrongly, and we're very lucky to escape with our lives, I think, in some cases. I personally had a great problem with mine, and mine was full up with water, so I was kept afloat by my life jacket. Having got the life rafts launched, it was quite obvious that there was no way the ship was going to survive, and we abandoned ship after about 15 or 20 minutes. And this happened all down the starboard side of the ship. A number of people were fairly reticent about jumping in the water. As I was fit and healthy, I decided that I should swim to the furthest life raft. So I swam about 30 yards to a life raft, which fully clothed and with a once-only suit in the middle of the sea, actually seemed like miles. Having got to the life raft, we all clambered in. And much of what we were doing at this point was straight from basic training. There was no question of thinking too much. It was just a question of our immediate reactions and our normal training. Although I hadn't sat in a life raft since the swimming pool at Dartmouth in 1976. Having got in the life raft, we then tried to sort ourselves out, find the knife to cut the lanyard, cut the line from the ship. And most of the life rafts were filling up with people. We must have had about 30 or 40 in and around our life raft. The problem was trying to sort ourselves out with rubber suits quite often, which were full of water. Trying to sort ourselves out inside the life raft was very amusing. It was more like a game of sardines than it was a service drill. At this point, of course, it was beginning to get towards sunset. I suppose if we'd have thought about it, we might have been a bit worried. But it's not the sort of thing you think about. You think you're safe, so it's no problem. We tried to sort ourselves out in the life raft, and there were a number of people in and around. And we battened it down and carried out the right sort of drill. The only problem was, in those days, perhaps our training lacked the survival training, which we now have as part of our regular training. And as I say, I hadn't been in a life raft for 6 years. And now to remember what happened 6 years beforehand was very difficult. However, we improvised. We bailed out with our mugs, which we had for action snacks. And we paddled with our respirators, which were very useful. The respirators, of course, being no biological, chemical or nuclear threat, were of little use to us in the Falklands. But they made excellent paddles by bending the straps over the other side and putting them on your hand, rather like a very big baseball glove. Having got clear and established, they were very quickly, broadsword, of course, was still in attendance, although she might have had a minor fire in around the flight deck, having been hit, and she had a number of cannon holes in the side. There were a number of helicopters very quickly there. We had one or two badly burnt people who went off in the first helicopter, and broadsword's whaler, or broadsword's seaboat, was pottering around trying to shepherd the life rafts. Some interesting stories from other people. One life raft went round the port side of the ship and was impaled on the sea dart, which was still on the launcher. And so their life raft began to sink as well. So not only were they sunk in their ship, they also sunk in their life raft. However, they all happily escaped from that. I was picked up by the second or third helicopter trip in a Seeking Mark IV, which is a commando helicopter, winched up, and then taken away. By the time, I suppose we must have been in the life raft an hour and a half or so, by the time I was in the helicopter and leaving, the ship was already upside down and floating with just the keel above the water. The helicopter then took however many of us were in there back into Falkland Sound, And I think at this stage we it was getting towards the sort of time of day when air tracks were normally finished. But we were felt relatively safe, I think, post trauma shock or something. We went to where the hospital was in Ajax Bay and dropped off a couple of injured people. And we also then went to another ship to top up fuel with a refuel helicopter. And then we were delivered to Fort Austin a few minutes later. We were all evicted while the helicopter went to pick up more people. So all the survivors were picked up either by broadsword or by helicopter from the Sea Kings, taken to Fort Austin. I was one of those who had a list of ship's company in my possession, and so one of my early choices was to hand this in as a nominal role. In Fort Austin, the officers were put into a small office, and probably very much against medical opinion, we were all given a can of beer, which seemed to make us feel much better. And I happened to bump into a couple of old friends of mine, so we had a chat. And I suppose by about 10 or 11 o'clock at night, most of the people now on board Fort Austin, and we were issued with a blanket temporarily, and a sort of survivor's kit, which comprised a pair of trousers, a woolly pulley, and a pair of plimsolls, if you were lucky. In retrospect, I was very lucky because I hung on to the trousers, the clothes I was wearing, so I was well off having almost two sets of clothes. Lessons from that is always have a sort of spare toothbrush in your pocket and a spare pair of underpants for the journey home. And it's amazing what little things then tend to become major items later. We sailed the following morning in daylight, which worried us a little bit. By that stage we'd had a sleep and we'd relaxed a bit, from Falkland Sound, and we sailed out past the main fleet units and did a boat transfer with Stromness, what must have been a couple of hundred miles east of the Falklands. No, later that afternoon anyway. We were all quite concerned as we sailed, because Fort Austin was a big target, lots of ammunition and fuel and stores on board, and also that we didn't have any anti-flash, because our anti-flash had either been burnt off for the people who were involved in the between decks, all was wet and therefore pretty useless. And as we sailed out, we went to air raid warning red, which meant there was an air attack imminent. And so we were all probably more scared then than at any other time. However, we stuck together as a team, and that was important. We transferred by boat to Stromness, and we spent 2-3 days steaming to South Georgia. The interesting thing about Stromness, she was one of the last RFAs with a Hong Kong Chinese crew. And so we lived on sort of Chinese for a couple of days, which was great fun. But I think the traumatic time was not being hit, because you revert to training. The traumatic time was perhaps the following morning when we were back under air attack, but we felt safe because we'd been rescued, and yet here we were under threat again. And that was the hardest, for me, the hardest time of the lot. And I remember sitting down in the main passageway, tween decks in Fort Austin, with a towel over my head, hoping that this would work as well as anti-flash would. We were very well looked after in Fort Austin, and we were very well looked after from then on all the way back home.
What exactly is this anti-flash?
Anti-flash could best be described as a white balaclava and a pair of long white evening gloves, made of fire-retardant material and coated with a nose bag that comes over your nose, so that all that is visible is a sort of area that would normally be covered by a pair of glasses. And the gloves come up to your elbows, and these are to cover the areas that would normally be unprotected by your normal fire-retardant clothes, in case of flash burns. Heavy duty cotton with impregnated with fire retardant material.
How many casualties did you have on the Coventry? You know, approximately. You know, was it a large number or?
No, I think we were very lucky. I think we only had about 19 dead. We'd out of a ship's company of about 293 or thereabouts. It was really quite staggering. I think we were very, very lucky indeed. There were a number of quite horrific flash burns, but most of those recovered really quite well later. And I saw one of the casualties about 6 months later, and he was looking as right as rain and with very few problems, yet he'd had most of his clothes burnt off with flash burns.
Was there much panic, you know, after this occurred, would you say? You know, you were saying how well the training worked out, that it all went according to training. But, you know, this was the real thing after all, and I wonder about the degree of panic.
Certainly, as far as I could see, there was no panic whatsoever. In fact, people became abnormally calm. I've often tried to analyse my own actions. I was on the bridge and I walked along the signal deck and I wondered what to do, and a little voice said, go and see how your chaps are. So I wandered along the gun direction platform and around the signal deck and asked how they were, and they were, whether they were okay and happy, and they were fine, no problems. So I think people reverted to their training, and as such there was no panic. But I don't think there was any need for us to panic on the upper deck, rationally. But I'm not sure that rationality makes any part of the proceedings. Certainly there was very little need to worry too much at that stage.
I was thinking also, you know, abandoning ship and getting into the lifeboats. You've explained the sort of difficult, you know, the physically difficult problems. But there again, you know, was there any sort of mad rush or panic?
No, not really. In fact, people were quite reticent about jumping over the side. Sailors are very loath to jump into the water. I suppose the only real bit of leadership I had to do was to lead them, a little group, jumping in the water. By this stage, the ship was heeling up very badly, and the port gunwale was underwater. That is, the upper deck on the port side was the water level. Some people slid down, some people went down the scrambling nets down the side. I was far enough forward that there wasn't too much of a camber and I was able to jump straight in. I remember thinking it was a bit like hands to bathe. But there were quite a few people in the water already, and we all had inflated life jackets, and we knew what we had to do and we just got on and did it. There was no panic whatsoever.
And how about getting the wounded up and evacuated? Did you see any of that? You know,
No, I didn't, because we were very fortunate, and the majority of people were either well and untouched, or those who were badly hurt, there were very few of them, or there were those who were killed, and those who were killed were killed outright. Beneath the ops room, in the computer room, everyone just about was killed. But they were killed almost instantly. And similarly with a number of other places around the ship where people were killed, everyone was killed, and there were no very badly injured people that I was aware of anyway.
And they would have gone down with the ship, would they? The killed people?
Oh, yes. I mean, the ship was upside down within 45 minutes. But by that stage, just about everyone had escaped.
What does the captain do at moments like this, you know, on occasions like this? What was your captain? Were you aware of his actions?
Well, the captain came via the bridge, and we got him out onto the port bridge wing within seconds of being hit, when the bridge was covered in smoke. And his orders were quite rational and calm, and said we ought to head east at the best speed. But having said that, I mean, there was no way we could move anywhere because we were losing power and we had no steering at that stage. So perfectly rational and logical thought, which I imagine was brought out by training, but totally impossible to carry out. So the captain is there to show leadership and care for the men.
Where were you actually when the bomb struck? You know, what were you doing?
I was lying down on the deck on the starboard side of the bridge. taking cover. My main thought was the fact that we hadn't actually scrubbed the bridge, which was my part of ship. Hadn't actually scrubbed the bridge for a couple of days, and it was about time we did it. But around us were all people who were very closely together. So we were just lying down there together.
And were you on duty at that? You know, obviously you were at action stations. Were you looking after your signal? You checked up on your boys, you said. So were you in charge of the signals at that stage?
No, I was there as a spare officer watch. We moved our people around the ship. And I was on the bridge helping the officer watch and the navigator. Also in the vicinity was one of the other warfare officers. And a couple of signalmen and the quartermaster and the boatswain's mate.
Well, was it very frightening when all this happened? You know, I wonder how you felt.
At the time, no, not at all. I'd say the only time it became frightening was the following morning when we were in Fort Austin, because you didn't have any control, perhaps you didn't have any control over what you were doing. You were there as a passenger. Whereas before, when you were doing something, you were in action. You were fighting your ship. Whereas if you were a passenger of somebody else's ship, and you knew that ship was very vulnerable, then it became frightening. Mm.
Yes, I wonder if this made you empathise with the people on Sir Galahad, near that...
No, not really, because it wasn't until at least I returned home that we heard anything about that. There are a number of instances, you know, that we didn't know anything about until much later. Atlantic Conveyor, for example. Although that was hit on the same day, we didn't know anything about that until... I probably didn't know about it until we got home.
But from what you've described, this all happened very quickly. You know, the way the ship started to sink and actually went down. Did it surprise you how quickly things happen?
No, not really, because time stands still. It might have been worse if we'd just spent a long time trying to save the ship. But as it was, the ship was... There was almost no way it was going to be saved, having had 3,000-pound bombs go off in her. And within 5 minutes, she was heeling over to about 30, 40 degrees, perhaps. By the time we abandoned, she was gunwale under. And by the time we were in our life raft and away, she was virtually on her side. As I say, by the time I was in the helicopter, the last thing I saw of the ship was upside down. So it happened very quickly. But you don't have time to think in those sort of circumstances.
Has it worried you since then? You know, but has it worried you since? You know, do you relive that experience at all?
I did when I was at home. One night we lived at the estate relatively close to a railway line, and in the middle of the night a goods train went through at high speed, and I was leaping out of bed and taking cover on the ground. And to Portland, the next time I went down there, it was about 3 months later in a ship which I was navigating. One of the things you do as you come into the harbour is to fight off a low-level air attack, and that did get me very worried. The very first time I went to sea after the Coventry incident, I was in a ship doing some navigation training prior to taking up this job as a navigator, and the ship heeled over, and that made me very worried. But since then, I haven't been so worried in a ship. But I have been more concerned about the unstableness of the world and the sort of volatile nature of many of these out-of-area places. I was in the Mediterranean when the Americans attacked Libya. And we were about 4 or 5 days short of the operation off Aden. We were relieving the group that was down there. In 83, we went back to the Falklands. We went around Cape Horn on one occasion, which is a bit close to Argentina for my liking. And we had a couple of false alarms while we were down there. And the second half of the year, we went out to the Gulf. And then we were diverted on the way back from the Gulf to sit off Beirut for 3 weeks. And a number of instances like that do make you realise how vulnerable you are and how volatile the world is and how quickly things can change. So I'm not so much worried these days about being in a ship, but I am more worried about where the ship's going. And you realise the uncertainty of it all.
You were saying that There were alterations, you know, after the sinking of Coventry. For instance, survival training, that this had an effect. The lessons of Coventry had an effect on your survival training. Were there any other effects, do you think? Were lessons learnt from that episode, or from the Falklands generally, you know, the sort of naval experience that have been put into practice ever since?
I think we've learned more lessons about fire-retardant clothing and about kit to wear in action, and I think we've taken great steps forward that way. I think we learned quite a lot about our ships. I think the argument about whether ships are made of aluminium and therefore burn more easily is completely irrelevant. If you get to the melting point of aluminium, then I don't think many people are going to be hanging around wondering whether it's safe for people to be there. So I think that is all hogwash. I think we have relearned the lessons about air defence and air cover. It was a very expensive lesson to learn. We learnt it in 1941 with the Prince of Wales getting sunk without air cover. We relearnt it many times during the Second World War, and I think we've relearnt it again in the Falklands. But it's a very expensive way of doing it, and it's one of those things that people are quite happy to forget in peacetime. But when you require people to do a job, then you expect to give them the tools. And if you don't give them the right tools, then they won't be able to do the job. And this is one case where you need the right tools. And the right tools is organic air cover.
Because, am I right in thinking that the carriers might not have, had it happened a year later, you might not have had the carriers? Is that right?
Well, my understanding of the 1981 Defence Review meant that a year later we might not, certainly wouldn't have had at least one of the carriers, might not have had both, and we might even have had sold, by all accounts, one of the assault ships to Argentina, if not scrapped both of them, as well as perhaps a number of other minor changes. But I think had it occurred a year later, we certainly wouldn't be able to carry out the operation.
So has this had an effect on naval thinking then? You know, are the carriers being maintained or increased?
I would like to think they're being maintained. I don't think we're that short-sighted to get rid of them. I also think it was a great boost in the arm for the Royal Marines, who perhaps are our greatest land force, the most flexible force we've got, and yet have been under threat for many years now. And I believe the threat to the amphibious shipping would have meant a threat to the Royal Marines and would have done us a great disservice in the long run.
And how about the missiles, you know, the Sea Wolf, Sea Dart? Because this would have been the first time, am I right in thinking, that they have been fired in a war situation? You know, did they fulfil the expectations, or were deficiencies brought to light, would you say?
I think they fulfilled their expectations. But having said that, we were just before we sailed, we were still doing trials on the 909 radar, for example. So it was very much state-of-the-art in terms of getting it to sea, although you must bear in mind that from conception to operational use is actually quite a long time for a major weapon system, particularly a ship, and can be as much as 15 years. I think perhaps any deficiencies were highlighted, we were probably already aware of them. I think CEDAR certainly performed very well, and the number of occasions we used it, I think we had a reasonable amount of success. There are occasions when you will not always have success, but you have to use what you've got. In terms of what we had, it was a very potent weapon. The 909 radar had a lock-on, i.e. it was able to acquire and track and provide a fire control solution for its target far in excess of the range of the missile. And we found at one stage that we thought aircraft were turning away because we locked onto them too early. And so we had to track them longer and then lock on at the last minute in order to give us a chance to fire the missile. So from those aspects, I think our weapons systems were very good. In terms of air defence, one of the things we did learn was the ships were very underprotected when it came to small arms, 20mm, 30mm weapon systems, point defence stuff. We had perhaps gone too far in terms of sophisticated missile systems, which worked very well, but had forgotten about the inshore battle, perhaps. But what we were fighting was not a 1980s Atlantic Ocean battle, and our threat, and our primary threat, was the Soviets, and still is. And as such, we must gear our needs to that. If you're fighting an inshore battle against 1960s technology, then perhaps Steadfast Exocet, then you need slightly cruder, more agricultural weapon systems.
The Exocets, did you have the right sort of countermeasures to use against them, the counter-technology for Exocets? Am I right in thinking the Soviet Navy does not have them?